Today is Wednesday, August 12th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Joe Biden finally reveals his choice for a vice presidential running mate.
Former President Obama is among those hailing the choice, saying Biden, his former vice president, nailed the decision.
Russia claims it's the first nation to approve a coronavirus vaccine. Experts are skeptical.
That is way too early in the process to actually approve a vaccine.
Also ahead, a new trend emerging for enjoying a night out while social distancing. It's all on today's International Edition. The Democratic presidential ticket is set with Joe Biden picking his running mate, AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
For the first time, a major party's ticket has a black woman. Biden has tabbed California Senator Kamala Harris to run with him, calling her one of the nation's finest public servants. Harris tweets she's honored and that Biden can unify the American people. Former President Obama is among those hailing the choice, saying Biden, his former vice president, nailed the decision. President Trump quickly tweeted a campaign ad dismissing Harris as a phony, and one that said the Democratic ticket jointly embraces the radical left. Sagar Magani, Washington.
During a news conference later in the day Tuesday, President Trump responded to the choice of Harris.
She was very, very nasty to one of the reasons that surprised me. She was probably nastier than even Pocahontas. To Joe Biden. She was very disrespectful to Joe Biden.
Trump referring to her tough attacks on Biden during the primary debates. Joining us now for analysis on Biden's choice of Kamala Harris as his vice president and what it could mean for the campaign is Jennifer Lawless, professor of politics at the University of Virginia. She's also the author and co-author of 6 books, including Women on the Run, Gender, Media, and Political Campaigns in a Polarized Era. Thank you so much for being with us. Initial reaction to the choice?
I think it was the strongest pick and the safest pick. Kamala Harris has the background that will really propel the ticket, both in terms of her prosecutorial background, but also her Senate experience. And in terms of politics, she's demonstrated a willingness to fight really hard on the campaign trail. And that's going to get under Donald Trump's skin.
What does it say about the former vice president that he chose someone that probably went after him harder in the debates than anybody else? And it probably would have had many people thinking they'd be enemies after that.
Well, first, I think it demonstrates that when he said he doesn't hold grudges, he means he doesn't hold grudges. Second, I think he's willing to put the future of the country ahead of a spat on the debate stage. If he thinks that she's the best opportunity to move forward and to defeat Donald Trump, he's going to take it. And third, I think it really serves as a great juxtaposition with Donald Trump, because if anybody holds grudges, it's Trump. And so by virtue of picking Kamala Harris, Joe Biden has demonstrated how different he is in terms of personality and in terms of style than the current occupant of the White House.
What about Kamala herself? Besides her savvy prosecutorial skills, what do you think some of the other things that she brings to this ticket? And do they change anything as far as the campaign itself?
It's helpful that as a former prosecutor, she is able to talk about Black Lives Matter without making it synonymous with defunding the police. That puts the Democratic ticket in a much better position. It makes it difficult for Donald Trump to argue that this is a ticket that doesn't believe we should have police officers across the country when Kamala Harris's background suggests otherwise. I also think that it's really important to highlight that although she's only a freshman senator, during her time in the Senate, she's gained a working knowledge of Washington and the current senators. Biden's been out of the Senate for a long time, and so she's also able to navigate and be familiar with the current personalities who are going to be vital, especially if the Democrats wind up taking back the Senate, who are going to be vital to ensuring that they have the votes they need to move legislation forward.
What about the fact that she is a Black woman, but also of Asian descent?
That, I think, think is very, very important because it highlights that Joe Biden is aware of the fact that the Democratic Party is diverse. He's aware of the fact that the Democratic coalition depends strongly on people of color and women of color in particular. And when he said he's going to make sure that his administration looks like America, this is the first decision he's had to make. And it suggests that he's taking that seriously.
Do you think that this decision could actually increase turnout?
I think it can generate enthusiasm that might have been tepid. Donald Trump and the Trump administration seem to be motivating Democrats to turn out. So the fact that Joe Biden wasn't necessarily everybody's first choice or people weren't that enthusiastic about him didn't seem to be as much of a liability as we might expect, given Democrats and some independents' distaste for the president. But there's no question that she can help. It's also important to note, she's cool. On the campaign trail, she's cool. When she's doing media interviews, she's cool. And the same way that Barack Obama was able to communicate to people, she can get out there on the campaign trail and talk to people in a way that doesn't make her seem like a stuffy politician. That's going to also juxtapose this ticket, I think, from the Trump-Pence ticket.
And do you think that the things that you just said can overcome whatever disappointments some more progressives may have about the choice?
I think that Joe Biden has demonstrated, and if you look at the speaking list for the convention with Bernie Sanders, with Elizabeth Warren, with AOC, he's demonstrated that he's taking very, very seriously advice and counsel from the more progressive wing of the party. And I wouldn't be surprised if they're heavily represented in the cabinet and in the administration more broadly. But at the end of the day, this has to be somebody that he feels like he can work with and that he agrees with and that will complement him. And most people would agree, I think, that it's better to have a ticket where the two people like each other, get along, and are able to campaign together, especially in a very bizarre environment right now, then check off a series of boxes on policies where the big differences are not really between the moderates and the progressives on the Democratic side. They're between the Democrats and the Republicans.
What do you foresee coming at Biden and Harris from the Trump campaign going forward?
I think one line of argument will be that it's about identity politics and that the Democratic Party only cares about making sure that they're talking to people of color or women, and it'll sort of play into the message that the Trump campaign established in 2016, which was basically, if you're a white guy, you should be very afraid. The country is moving away from you. And so I think a pick like Kamala Harris allows them to continue along with that argument. I don't think it'll be that effective this time around. First of all, it may have been effective because people didn't like Hillary Clinton. It may not have been that it was affected in and of itself. Second, it may have been effective then, except right now we're amid a pandemic and we're amid a terrible economy. So those circumstances have changed. The other type of attack that I can foresee is going to be a tough one for the Trump campaign because it's somewhat hypocritical, but they're going to suggest that she, as a prosecutor and as attorney general, made some bad decisions. The problem for them is that the decisions that they're going to be condemning are decisions that they probably would have made and that are certainly no worse than anybody in the Trump Justice Department.
Jennifer Lawless, professor of politics at the University of Virginia and author of Women on the Run, Gender, Media, and Political Campaigns in a Polarized Era. Harris joins Biden in the 2020 race at a moment of unprecedented national crisis with the coronavirus pandemic and economic issues that it's created, along with unrest across the country as Americans protest racism and police brutality. The protests are in their third month now, and while demonstrations are smaller, they are not slowing down, as VOA's Jason Patinkin and Ian Buehr report from Washington.
It's been more than 2 months since the United States erupted in protests following the death of African-American man George Floyd in police custody. Since then, millions have marched in cities across America demanding an end to systemic police brutality and racism. Some of the largest protests took place in the U.S. Capitol, Washington, D.C. Thousands marched here despite police at times firing tear gas, stun grenades, and other projectiles at largely peaceful crowds. While protests here are smaller now, numerous demonstrations still take place each weekend demanding prosecution of abusive police officers and defunding or abolishing of police departments. On a recent Saturday, over 100 protesters gathered at DuPont Circle in the heart of the nation's capital. They're mostly young and of many different races. One protester holds a sign that says Breonna Taylor was murdered in reference to a black woman shot and killed in her sleep this March by police officers in the U.S. state of Kentucky. The protester holding the sign is a white man who declines to give his name.
People are now more resolved because we're all still out here. It seems like the people who are still present are they're ready to see change. They're willing to. They don't care if they bring pepper spray. They probably would stay if they brought live ammunition, to be honest. It's because I know that when people see and hear the truth about what really happens out here, there's no way they wouldn't stand with us. There's no way that they wouldn't agree that these policemen have too much power and that they're the tip of a very long systemic racism spear. And we got to start with the tip, take it down so that we can get the rest of it done.
Another protester is 26-year-old black woman Jasmine Nicole. She says she joins the protests to show solidarity with demonstrators in Portland, Oregon, where thousands have taken to the streets to protest violence by local and federal police.
I'm here to stand in solidarity with Portland, but also because we have local issues here in D.C. So we're saying George Floyd and we're saying Breonna Taylor, but we also have local names to say.
Police in Washington, D.C. have killed 13 people since 2015, according to a Washington Post database. 12 of those killed were black. Nicole says protests in D.C. have changed over the past 2 months.
There's definitely been a fluctuation of the crowd. Sometimes it'll be a few people or a large crowd. I will say the crowds have gotten smaller, so I'm happy to see so many people out here tonight. And I've also seen more protests other places, like to urge the D.C. City Council to follow through on the demands that we're saying out here in the streets. So I've seen, like, more protests in different places.
Before sunset, the protesters block an intersection to read names of people killed by police.
Jane Thompson was murdered.
Jane Thompson!
Then they walk through a public park where dozens of city residents are relaxing. The protesters say they want to disturb people from their recreation into taking action. A few people in the park get up and leave, but most sit and listen to the protesters. Some raise their fists in support. After dark, the march moves onto a highway, blocking all cars except emergency vehicles, like this ambulance. The protesters sit down in the highway to rest, drink water, and eat snacks. Dion Antoine Ingram is a black man in his late 30s.
Not just shooting by the police.
He says he's protesting to force changes to the U.S. criminal justice system, which the Institute for Crime and Justice Policy Research says incarcerates more people per capita than any other country.
I have uncles, I have cousins who all did time in the justice system. You know what I mean? I'm talking about nonviolent crimes, 20, 30 years, nonviolent crimes. You know what I mean? So my family, my loved ones, has all been molested by the criminal justice system. Treated poorly, treated unfairly, mistreated. You know what I mean?
Ingram says he is impressed to see people of all races joining the protests.
I've been down here for basically like 41 days every day. And the diversity down here, the love, the unity, it means so much to me.
After their rest, the protesters leave the highway and march on through city streets. They'll do it again next weekend, as long as it takes, they say, for their demands to be met. With my VOA colleague Ayan Bior, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington.
Russia says it is the first country to approve a coronavirus vaccine. The announcement Tuesday was met with international skepticism. University of Southampton senior research fellow Michael Head says Russia's released little proof about the vaccine's safety or effectiveness.
It appears as though the vaccine has only been tested on a few dozen people. So we're really at too early a stage to truly assess whether it's going to be effective, whether it's going to work or not.
Scientists in Russia and other countries say a rush to start using the vaccine could backfire. It took 6 months for the world to reach 10 million confirmed cases of the coronavirus. It took just over 6 months for that number to double. The worldwide count of known COVID-19 infections climbed past 20 million on Monday, more than half of them from the U.S., India, and Brazil. That's according to Johns Hopkins University. The real infection numbers are below believed to be much higher given limitations on testing and the many mild cases that have gone unreported. The World Health Organization is releasing guidance on measures to be taken by dental health professionals and patients in oral health services to minimize the risk of being infected with COVID-19. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
As everyone in the world can attest, having a toothache is no fun, and when the pain is bad enough, people will go to the dentist. However, a World Health Organization survey of 103 countries between May and mid-July finds COVID-19 has affected dental services around the world in unprecedented ways. Dental officer in WHO's Department of Non-Communicable Diseases, Benoit Varenne, says 75% of survey respondents reported dental services have been completely or partially disrupted because of the coronavirus. He says the high level of disruption is linked to the nature of the work provided by the oral healthcare personnel.
As you know, dentists, dental nurses, hygienists, and dental assistants work in close contact with patients and are exposed to saliva and blood. And also they are using what we call spray-generating equipment. And all this equipment are generating what we call airborne particles or aerosol.
In communities where transmission of the coronavirus is high, Varenne says WHO recommends priority be given to urgent or emergency oral cases. And in the treatment of patients, he says dental workers should avoid or minimize procedures that may generate aerosols, which can spread the infection, and prioritize the use of hand instruments.
And of course, to delay routine, non-essential oral health care. This means oral health checkup, dental cleaning, preventive care, and certainly also some aesthetic dental treatment.
Other WHO recommendations include remote screening, maintaining physical distancing, and wearing masks before and in between dental sessions to prevent and reduce the risk of transmission. Varenne says one of the most pressing issues is to ensure all dental workers have personal protective equipment. This is essential, he says, to protect themselves from becoming infected with COVID-19 and passing it on to their patients. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Angry and grieving protesters Tuesday read aloud the names of at least 171 people killed in last week's explosion at Beirut port and called for the removal of Lebanon's president and other officials they blame for the tragedy. They observed a minute of silence marking 1 week at 6:08 p.m. local time, the moment on August 4th that thousands of tons of ammonium nitrate exploded in the city's port, where it had been stored for more than 6 years, apparently with the knowledge of top political officials. The catastrophic explosion injured thousands and plunged Lebanon into a deeper political crisis. So what's next for the country and its people? To help with that question, International Edition's Steve Miller spoke to Emily Hawthorne, Middle East and North Africa analyst at Stratfor, a RAIN company.
This really is the key question. We are at a precipice for Lebanon. The question is, does the government and the political structure in Lebanon return to business as usual, and we see the same kind of sectarian entrenchment and corruption that caused a lot of these protests that began before the port explosion? Or do we actually see this as a bit of a Chernobyl moment, something that forces a change in the regime and leads to new structural reforms? And I don't think anyone can answer that question right now.
Trying to figure out what's next for the country is difficult, but it's not alone in the region. So how is the economic crisis compounded with this humanitarian crisis in Beirut going to affect the region?
Yet Lebanon is dealing with a serious currency crisis as well as a debt crisis. Its banks are under pressure, but really the people suffering are those who put their money into the banks for years and years and years. So Lebanon's financial sector used to be really a banking haven, a banking headquarters for the whole Middle East region. That hasn't been the case in the last several years as the banking sector has come under strain. But it is fair to say that if you do see a banking sector collapse in Lebanon, which is a possibility right now with the severity of the financial crisis, that will have a ripple effect in the broader region. Lebanon is an important place in the Arab world, so a collapse there is not going to just be contained within its borders.
Is this enough to actually instill long-time change in the country?
To many protesters, to many regular Lebanese people, the resignations matter, but they simply are not enough, because without actual electoral or structural government reform, you're just going to see a revolving door of the same personalities going back into the same kinds of positions. So what many Lebanese want is an actual change to how the system is run, to how elections are held.
How do you get there?
You know, I think right now is a critical moment. If enough Lebanese from enough different sects and minorities and all the groups in this diverse country come together and continue demanding actual change from the government, and if external actors, the IMF, France, the United States, if external countries sort of condition their financial aid accordingly, only if there's going to be reforms, then I do think that we're at a place where you could see some of those reforms take place.
Emily Hawthorne, Middle East and North Africa analyst for Stratfor, a Rain company, speaking with International Edition's Steve Miller. French President Emmanuel Macron has earned kudos from many Lebanese and the international community for his proactive response to last week's explosion in Beirut. Praise he doesn't always hear at home these days, but some critics are raising old accusations of French neo-colonialist meddling, as Lisa Bryant reports from Paris.
President Macron is back in the international spotlight after making the first visit by a foreign leader last week to blast-crippled Beirut and co-hosting Sunday's virtual donors conference for the Lebanese, which raised nearly $300 million in humanitarian aid. It's a position the French president, who has spearheaded similar high-profile events on climate change, Libya, and the Sahel, for instance, seems to relish. Visiting Beirut, now rocked by massive anti-government protests, Macron was welcomed by residents who called him their only hope. A petition to return Lebanon to French mandate has gathered more than 60,000 signatures. Its organizers say the Lebanese government, which resigned on Monday, has been totally incapable of securing and managing the country. France says Lebanese aspirations for reforms and governance must be heard. It's been a while since Macron got such a hero's welcome back home, where his approval rating is an underwhelming 39%. In a sign of his difficult presidency, a French newspaper is running a series on the many crises he's faced, from the yellow vest protests to the coronavirus-crippled economy.
Macron wants to find a global role. He's in a very difficult situation in France.
That's former French diplomat and geopolitical expert Philippe Moreau de Farge. He says there's one towering French figure in the backdrop, former World War II hero turned president Charles de Gaulle.
He wants to be a new de Gaulle, you know. He would like to do something for Lebanon.
Ties between Lebanon and France stretch back centuries. Following World War I, Lebanon, as well as Syria, was placed under French mandate. Despite de Gaulle's reluctance, it achieved independence in 1943.
Lebanon was a Christian country, and there is relation, very, very multi-century relation between France and Lebanon. There is a connection between France and Lebanon which is beyond colonialism.
Not all Lebanese or French see it that way. French far-right National Rally spokesman Julien Sanchez called Macron's moves opportunistic. How would French like it, he told French radio, if U.S. President Donald Trump protested with the yellow vests on the Champs-Élysées? Others, including French leftist politicians, claim Macron's actions reflect a colonial mindset that has never disappeared. Lebanon is in urgent need of a new new pact, wrote journalist and commentator Ramzi Baroud in Gulf News, but not one engineered by France. France has faced similar accusations before. Its Barkhane peacekeeping operation, for example, has sparked protests in Mali and Niger. Macron's message is only Lebanon can solve Lebanon's problems, but not everyone believes it. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. Activists and a freelance journalist are among the latest people under Hong Kong's new national security law to be arrested. They're all accused of colluding with foreign powers. A Southern California area hospital, immigrant advocacy groups, and Americans living in Mexico are criticizing a U.S. government draft proposal that could block U.S. citizens and permanent residents from entering the country if they're suspected of being infected with the novel coronavirus. And Belarusian opposition leader Svetlana Tikhanouskaya said Tuesday she had fled abroad for the sake of her children after strongman leader Alexander Lukashenko's claim of victory in Sunday's presidential election prompted bloody street protests. Tikhanouskaya, a 37-year-old former English teacher who took her husband's place on the ballot after he was jailed, fled to neighboring Lithuania. You're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Dante, AU, African Youth, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
VOA's International Edition continues. Twice weekly charter flights of up to 80 people who Italian authorities describe as illegal economic migrants resumed this week from Italy to Tunisia. The flights, part of an Italian-Tunisian agreement, were put on hold during Italy's COVID-19 lockdown. Italy saw a sharp increase in migration last month that has put a strain on migrant reception centers, particularly in the south of the country. Sabina Castelfranco has more for VOA from Rome.
The growing number of illegal immigrants arriving from North Africa concern the Italian authorities, who have had a number of recent meetings with their Tunisian counterparts to address the issue. At the end of July, Foreign Minister Luigi Di Maio said that unless Tunisia took significant measures to rein in the departures, Italy would suspend €6.6 million in cooperation funds for Tunisia's development. After a spike in Tunisian arrivals, Italian Interior Minister Luciana Lamorgese flew to Tunis at the end of last month.
Sì, a luglio sono arrivati, si sono moltiplicati gli arrivi da parte della Tunisia.
She said that in July the number of illegal Tunisian migrants reaching Italy increased significantly due to the country's serious economic crisis. These, she added, are economic migrants who have no right to remain in Italy. Italy's requests, including the stepping up of controls along the Tunisian coastline and a resumption of the twice-weekly repatriation flights that were taking place ahead of the COVID-19 lockdown in Italy. More than 4,000 Tunisians have arrived in Italy since the start of this year. Following the pressure applied by the Italian Foreign Ministry, Tunisia agreed to resume the flights and said it would increase patrol teams and surveillance along its coastline in order to stem illegal migration towards Italy. Reception centres in Italy, having to deal with the COVID-19 emergency, have been struggling to cope with the number of migrants, who amount to 14,000 since the start of the year. The reception center in the southern island of Lampedusa again reached its bursting point at the start of this month. The center at Pozzallo in southern Sicily reached a similar point, and migrants began leaving the center. Italian authorities are now testing all migrants who arrive on its shores for coronavirus and have deployed ships off the coast of Sicily and Calabria where migrants can isolate. After their 14-day quarantine, the migrants will move to a variety of reception centers across Italy. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
The coronavirus pandemic has led to a revival of sorts for drive-in theaters in and around the U.S. It's a way for families and couples to get out together while still socially distancing. It's a tradition that also seems to be expanding beyond just movies. Heavy metal group Metallica is set to be the first act featured in a series of concerts that will be shown at drive-ins across America. The band will film a full concert to be shown as part of the Encore Drive-In Night series on August 29th. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Bundanyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London!
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour.
Whoa.
Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA, or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world.
Ah.
Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music.
Wake up, dance this music. Balance.
Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.